Mr. Pringle made the perfect segue into the next topic we need to cover. In fact, I think it's one of the most vital topics. When you talk about our enemy's power in this country and around the world, you're talking about political power. If you are in political office, you have power to affect the laws, how things are done, what happens in our society. And the only way we can ultimately change society is at least in part through the political process. Now, I believe there's going to be massive times. I mean, I think we should even look into, as Sam Dixon told me the other day, the passive resistance of people like Gandhi. They taught a lot. You get enough people out there of our persuasion, and they simply decide not to go to work, the whole country changes in an instant. They have a lot on the internet right now about blogs and people where instant meetings that are formed where hundreds or thousands of people will come together. Imagine when we have millions of people on our networks or email networks and internet networks, and we could call a meeting, and in 24 hours, we might have 100,000 people in the streets. That's real power. But we have to begin to translate that sentiment into real concrete power. And where is the place that we go? How do we begin that process? We're going to hear in a few minutes from James Edwards. First, we're going to hear from Howie Farrell and Kenny Knight. Now, when they talk about how you organize politically, what your thinking should be in terms of what offices to go for, what offices to contest, when they talk about these issues, they're talking from the experience of victory. You remember my race in 1989, I'm sure, for the House of Representatives here in Louisiana. The whole world, it seemed like, was against me in that race. The governor came out against me. The lieutenant governor came out against me. Both U.S. senators came out against me. Every U.S. representative came out against me. Almost every state senator and local representative came out against me. The mayor came out against me. As I said then, I was waiting for the Ayatollah Khomeini to show up. He's the only guy that didn't make it to that race. The president of the United States said that he got on the radio in this local House race and said, I want you to vote against David Duke. But these gentlemen were part of that process that in which we won the election. Now, I see a tendency, and I'm going to turn the floor very quickly to them. I see a tendency of people around the country, people who are novices to politics. They come along and they come to me every day and they say, I'm ready to dedicate my life. I want to run for office. I say, well, what do you want to run for? I want to run for Congress. I want to run for Senate, U.S. Senate. I want to run for president. And they never had one bit of experience in canvassing. They don't know the first thing about politics. It is a skill. It is an art. It's something you got to know about. It's something you got to learn. You've got to learn it in the trenches. I would suggest any of you people to go out and get involved in some campaign, if someone you're compatible with anyway, and learn the process from underneath. And when you go for an office, and I hope, I'm looking at young people here and even older people here who will someday run for office, but run for an office where you can make the difference. So before I go into things they're going to talk about, I'm going to go ahead and introduce Howie Farrell, who is a former police officer. He's also... He's also a doctoral candidate. He's got a master's degree in history, I believe. He's been involved in many elections in Louisiana, and he was certainly instrumental in helping me win my first election and the tremendous vote we got on the statewide level in two major elections. Howie Farrell.
Thank you, David. I had a brief meeting with David the other day and discussing what it is that he wanted us to present. And he told me some of the things he wanted, and then he got up and he said them himself. So I don't know if that really leaves me much. But David's going to introduce you, Kenny. But let's... Why don't you
Okay. This is Kenny Knight. He also was very active in our campaign.
Thank you.
Also next to his office.
Kenny is a very proud Italian-American, and he really mobilized me. He's got that kind of energy. And he really worked very hard in the whole communities to get everybody lined up. But he's also a former police officer, very successful insurance agent in this community, and just a great friend and a great guy. So I'm going to turn it over to you.
But I haven't written a book, and I haven't been to jail, so.
Not yet.
You haven't written a book?
Not yet.
A few things that we'd like to touch on. First of all, with the capacities that Kenny and I worked in David's campaigns, Kenny was more of the nuts and bolts type guy, while I was more of the planner and the organizer. I would sit with David and draft the plans that we needed. We'd give the plans to Kenny, and Kenny would go out and get them done. So he was extremely important to us, and probably the most effective person that I've ever worked with as far as gaining support for us in the form of volunteers and also in procuring things that we needed, like soliciting the contributions of foods and sound stages and sound equipment and so forth for the Duke Fest that we used to put on annually. That was we drew over 14,000 people at one of those events one particular year. Kenny was responsible for most of that.
Had a big stick.
We did want to touch on a few things. David mentioned the fact that it's extremely important that we get candidates for public office. When David runs for office, can y'all hear me without the microphone? Okay. When David runs for office, he's out there alone. So the enemy can put all of their forces directly upon him, and it stymies our efforts. David has done a tremendous job. We got people elected into offices in Louisiana who heretofore would never have mentioned things like affirmative action. But because of David's success and the way he presented the issues to the Louisiana voter, very few of these neocons will run for office without making some genuflection toward the issues of affirmative action. They're not as committed as we need them to be. That's why we need other people running for office in the state of Louisiana, which we're starting to find some of these people. But we also need for you people to go home, identify good candidates, and get them to run for offices that they can win. And we're recommending that you start out with the smaller offices, because that's going to cost you the least amount of money, and you have to generate the least amount of volunteers and so forth. The success of your campaign, once you get into it, can be measured before any polls are taken, can be measured by how many volunteers you have working those streets for your campaign. If you don't have volunteers, you're not going to win. But if you're showing volunteers and you're showing a street presence, it affects the psyche of the voting public, and it just snowballs, and they buy into what it is you're doing. And then they say, you know, I've always believed in these issues anyway. And you have all of these people out in the street, and they're saying it publicly, I can do that too. I can put up a David Duke sign. I can go and hold a sign on the street corner, and I can make my presence known. So when we get a number of other people, you know, across this land running for various offices, and then we start getting this political infrastructure built to where we can not only influence the particular positions that they hold, but also influence other positions. I'll give you for instance. In the recent governor's election, state of Louisiana, the runoff came down to Bobby Jindal, who's an Indian American, not an American Indian, Indian American, and Kathleen Blanco, the Democrat. So Jindal was the Republican, dark-skinned Republican. Ms. Blanco was a name white, obviously, right? So she was the white Democrat in the race. Bobby Jindal made comments that he did not want to solicit the help of David Duke or any of his supporters. Well, that message went loud and clear to the David Duke campaign. And this is what Stephanie Grace had to say. And this comes from a particular, this is the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Times-Picayune, is dated Tuesday, April the 6th. And she said, we don't hear much about David Duke around here these days, the former Ku Klux Klan leader and state representative is still off in federal prison. Now, this is not very long ago, obviously. serving out the waning days of his sentence for mail fraud and tax evasion and his days of roiling Louisiana elections seemed to be long over. Duke voters, however, are another matter. The way two political scientists from Hamilton College in upstate New York see it, these voters, specifically the rural white North Louisiana voters where Duke's biggest backers played a decisive role in Kathleen Blanco's win over Bobby Jindal for governor. Yeah. The headline, you know, the headline is very important. I really should have read it. The so-called Duke vote can still win elections. When Bobby Jindal faux pas'd, you know, see, we had no candidate in a race. Blanco is not really a friend of ours. But when Jindal faux pas'd and said he wanted nothing to do with the Duke vote, well, we immediately got to our little contact list, started our telephone trees, and we started our email contacts across the state. And we literally got in touch with over 100,000 voters in the state of Louisiana. And that 100,000 voters, had they voted, or the whichever proportion of that would have voted, they probably would have voted for the neocon as opposed to the Democrat, because theoretically they're more conservative. What they're trying to conserve, a lot of us don't want to conserve, but they're more conservative. So when this word went out, these people shut it down. Most of them did not show up at the polls. So that extracted that 100,000 votes from the Jindal collection that he would have had on election day. The voter turnout was suppressed from when David Runsfeld with 60% turnout to less than 33% turnout in state of Louisiana. That's the impact that the Duke vote had in the governor's race in state of Louisiana just this past time around. Blanco won because Jindal said he didn't like us.
Okay. That's not common on mayor's race. He's a mayor's race. Mayor's race.
Well, I don't know if we want to do that right now. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get you people, how many of y'all from out of state? Okay, every one of y'all, find a candidate where you're from. If you can go back to your homes and find somebody and have them run, and you begin to get successful, then you can begin to support candidates that have the wherewithal to run on a statewide level and also in the national elections, whether it be Senate, Congress, or for the presidency. You got to have a base first. Kenny and I basically cut our teeth working for various political candidates when we were on the police department. We were founding members of the police union. We were rebels all our lives. Our activities did not endear us to the reigning political structure in the city of New Orleans at that time, and they still don't like us, basically. But we learned a lot of valuable lessons. We ended up working for a lot of people who we considered to be good, strong, Southern conservative people. Dave Treem, when he won the election for governor of state of Louisiana, it was the efforts of the New Orleans Police Department that had a huge influence on the local vote. And that influence came directly from the Pano group, which he and I both sat on the Pano board, and we helped orchestrate those efforts. We turned out many, many, in violation of the Little Hatch Act, we turned out an awful lot of volunteers in these various campaigns. But we cut our teeth on learning the electoral process and the campaigning process by working for these various candidates. I also studied political science while I was at Loyola, and while I was there, there's a well-known political scientist here in Louisiana by the name of Ed Renwick. Ed Renwick runs a school on campaigning, Loyola University. I took the class. It was a regular semester class. Took the class, made an A in it, so I think I did pretty good. In addition to that, the Republican Party puts on campaign schools. We had one put on by the Women Republicans here in the state of Louisiana. We had one put on by the PAC, the Republican PAC Committee here in the state of Louisiana. I attended both of those schools. And so what we did was we gleaned what we could from those, and we applied those elements of campaigning to the David Duke campaign. We're going to touch on those things in a little bit to show you how we were successful in what we did and how we still have an impact on various elections. And I was discussing this with David, and he can verify right now. We still intend to have an impact on a number of elections here in the state of Louisiana through the endorsement and influences of David's name.
And the internet. And the internet.
And the internet. The I had responded to some of the columns that were in the Times-Picayune, whether it was saying that we voted against Jindal because he just wasn't white enough. So Kenny and I put a letter together, and the Times-Picayune, I'm sure your local newspapers do the same thing. They edit what you write. But I'm going to read you what Kenny and I thought was a part of what we had to say, because this was edited. And I want you to understand that we thought we made stronger points than what I'm gonna list here, and they edited a lot of it out. And we also told them where to find the racism in the local black churches in the city of New Orleans, where they were complaining about the Mayor Nagin for being too white. Okay. Well, things happen, you know. See, we wrote the letter, and they titled our letter. Of course, they had all titles to it, and they titled our letter, "Opposition Was Not Racist." It says, "Racial bias likely in the Blanco win study shows," you know, this is what they're relating to, page A2 on April 4th, okay? The Associated Press article by Adam Nossiter cites the data of two New York political scientists. Their data indicate that in a recent race for governor of Louisiana, David Duke voters cast their votes for Kathleen Blanco because of a racial bias against Bobby Jindal. These two professors are in the right church but the wrong pew. True, Duke supporters worked feverishly against Jindal. As a former Duke campaign staffers, we contacted over 100,000 Duke supporters statewide to enlist their help in defeating Jindal. But not because of his race, but because of his caustic remarks directed at Mr. Duke and his supporters. Okay. Jindal freely expressed delight in supporting Edwin Edwards, that's who David ran against in the governor's race, for governor against David Duke. His verbal denunciation of Duke was also seen as an affront to Duke supporters and their conservative values. Although running as a Republican candidate with the veneer of a conservative, Jindal exposed himself not as a conservative, but as a neocon. In other words, a stingy liberal, biased against a large segment of Louisiana's residents and voters. And that's the portion of our letter that they printed. But I can tell you we got a little bit stronger than that. Of course, they didn't want to hear that. We're going to... next thing I'm going to cover along with Kenny, but I'm going to let him have a couple words first, and then we're going to let y'all vote to see who you want to hear from. And we're going to start covering some of the basics of running the anatomy of a campaign. Kenny?
Thank you, Howie. I think you can give me a chance. First of all, I have to throw a little humor at everything. Last night we were waving the Duke for Congress signs, and how's the saying goes? Been there, done that, got the T-shirt. They actually came in two colors, Duke blue and Caucasian white, remember? And of course, my favorite is, I don't know if you remember this one, we had a big party. Those were the good days, huh? Also, I thank you all for having an opportunity to speak here, and something that I'd like to mention, that on two occasions, my fiance and I, Barbara, drove to Big Spring, Texas to visit David, 13 and a half hours straight, nonstop,
814 miles from our front door. It's this little shithole town called Big Spring, Texas. There wasn't any McDonald's there. Excuse my French. And to spend time with my dear friend, and I have to say that the man had the most positive attitude under the circumstances than any human being that I know. Unbelievable. He was motivated, he was excited, and I didn't get a word in 4 hours. He just talked. And he started planning this, back in January, I think it was. And here we are today. Like I always said, that it was sort of divine providence, I think, that we all came together many years ago, back in 89, when David decided to run for the state legislature seat. It was a vacated spot. The timing was right. But we had to plan strategy, how to raise money, how to get volunteers, how to get the message out. And history proved was correct that when Newt Gingrich started the Contract with America concept to take Congress back, the Contract with America that was circulated among all registered Republicans was the platform that we wrote in David's basement in the winter of November of 1988, word for word. So he was actually the author of that, most of that contract. Right.
So Gingrich was a plagiarist.
Right, he was a plagiarist, yeah.
Oh, he is a plagiarist.
He is a plagiarist. I think the most important thing is that especially for the younger generation here, is that you either are a candidate or you're going to find a candidate. Okay? If you don't have what it takes to be a candidate, then seek and find a candidate that you can back and support, and you can encourage your friends, family, and co-workers, et cetera, to support. The most important thing is that you have to get to know the candidate. Make sure that he is true and loyal to your cause, you exchange the same ideas, and that you will not embarrass yourself at some point in time that you worked and supported him. Sometimes candidates flip-flop. The other thing, too, is the message. And
let's talk about the candidate a little bit.
Okay.
Going to the second, what we need to do as a candidate, I'm going to beg these younger guys here to prepare yourselves. Prepare yourselves to be a good candidate. And when you represent the white race, which is what we're asking you to do, please do so in a very dignified manner. Dress well, groom well, learn to speak well, learn the issues, and learn to present. Do not do it in an argumentative manner. Try to copy David Duke's lead on that. He can smile them to death. You see? When the opposition leaves the room with David, they leave smiling that they got killed. So prepare yourselves academically, prepare yourselves physically, try to stay healthy because it's a grueling task, and please, please, wear an attire that's going to show a pride in yourself and the people you're representing. And I don't mean that you directly. I'm saying when you find whoever the candidate is, make sure that they fit a good professional profile. Make sure they can represent our ideals to the nth degree, both in appearance and in verbal presentation. The message is extremely important when you're running as a candidate. We all want to make sure that we are backing people that feel as we do, as I'm sure, if not everyone in this room, at least 99 9/10 of us, the way we think and feel and what we'd like to see America return to. When we support a candidate, when we find a candidate, let's try not to be fooled by these neocons, which has happened to us so many times in the past. Let's try and make sure that they understand what it is we're looking for so that we can support a base that'll grow to our benefit. And I say our benefit, I'm talking about as a people, our children, our grandchildren, and we're hoping it's going to be for me too before I know much longer. So make sure that their message is correct, but make sure when they presenting themselves for the particular office that they're running, that the message that they're delivering for that office fits that office. We want to know what they're thinking, but we also want to know that they have a viable platform that can be received by the voter. We don't want to be talking about immigration if you're running for the school board. It doesn't apply. Got to find the issues that do apply and protect, if you're running for school board, let's protect the integrity of education. Let's protect the integrity of the student body. There are things we can discuss there. We can try to move for programs that separate the chafe from the student, move them into a different program. It's just some ideas. I think you all understand what we're talking about. Get the message that's going to be appropriate for the office that they're running for, and be sure that they're good, true, white, conservative candidates. And then we've got to go out and support them. This one is very important, okay?
Yeah, we'll split it. Financing. That's the toughest one. It costs money to run for public office, whether it's for a local council seat or statewide seat. You have to have the means and ways to be able to finance it. First off, when you decide you're going to make that run for that office or support a candidate for that office, you have to also have the friends and the contacts and the family members and the people who support you to help you raise the funds, from donations to coffee parties where you can raise money, to having a rally or party where you can ask people for donations. You also have to have your friends and family members solicit their friends and family members. You're trying to raise as much money as you can from every means you can. In some cases, a lot of candidates even go out and take equity loans against their houses or personal loans to finance that campaign. And also, be aware, too, of the campaign finance laws in your state. Make sure that you follow all campaign laws, because they're very strict about that, particularly here in Louisiana, and that all dollars that you collect and you put into your campaign checking account that are documented and recorded and you file on a timely basis. The other way would be that if you're going to support a candidate, you also have to maybe find ways and means to raise money for them. Again, using your warm base of friends and relatives, you start off with that and go out and seek donations for the candidates you chose to run for. That's probably the hardest part of running a campaign, is financing it, because you're not going to get big dollar donations from Coca-Cola, Mercedes-Benz, or whatever. You're going to have to find whichever means possible to raise the money. If you can't raise the money, then you're not going to be able to really be a viable candidate in an election. Any comments about that?
Well, I'm looking at our sheet here, and I forgot to put on their rallies as far
down
as
there.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's right. We'll get to that later.
Yeah, we'll get to that later. I'm going to get involved with this.
Sure. Okay, good.
You know anything about this?
A little. First, we have to tell a quick story. When we all got together at David's house, I think it was November of 88. Am I right on that?
Yeah.
I remember, yes. David had no heat in the house. It was freezing cold. We're drinking beer, talking about him running for election. I remember that?
Yeah.
Very cold.
Why didn't you have heat in your house?
His house was at one time had been a dairy, and he thought the milk was still in there.
Yeah.
You know? So it was freezing.
So there were five people in that room on that cold winter night drinking cold beer that when David said, you know, I'm going to run for the state representative race. And we broke up the meeting, and the next meeting only two people showed up. So we all,
instead of our numbers growing, Nate, they would.
We're all original candidates. We're all original candidates. And we said, well, Dave, where's all your friends, you know? He said, we're all it. So, okay. So start off with two people, two volunteers, and it grew into tens of thousands. And
you got to say the first group of people that stepped up to help us with the first thing we did was we started a phone bank, started contacting people. And the first group of people that came in to help us with this phone making, but we had eight lines in the
you had to learn how to climb a telephone pole and tap telephone lines and run them into your basement.
We started with eight telephone lines, and the first group of people that came out to help us with it was a local skinhead group. Now, We realize that they don't present very well knocking on doors, but on the telephone, nobody can see them, and they did great.
Very polite on the phone, but when we had rallies, we said, well, y'all might not come to the rallies, you know. Don't come to the rally.
We encourage them to come, but we ask them to stay within
put
our...
Put a cap on, you know.
Stay within our framework at a rally and not their framework at a rally, you know. So, but they were very, very helpful to us, and without that initial input from them, the campaign would not have generated the enthusiasm that it did and bring in the numbers of other volunteers. Volunteers!
Very important.
Kenny's fiance met her as a volunteer walk-in to David's campaign.
Barbara, you
so
can
if it wasn't for David
that.
Running for office, he would not have this fiance that he has.
But my wife was in the kitchen cooking when I met you. So. Good old days. Volunteers. We have to move on, but volunteers are very important. You have to go, again, if you're going to run as a candidate or support a candidate of your choice, you'll have to go back to your closest friends and your relatives, people who owe you favors, people you've done favors for, and say, hey, I need a favor. You know, I'm going to run for whatever, and I have a little phone bank set up in my living room, and I need you to come over here from 6 to 9, 6 to 8. Make some calls for me with a pre-planned script. And believe me, I would take 10 loyal volunteers that I could depend on than an army of 1,000. Because I know that when the phone calls have to be made or the canvassing has to be made, I could depend on those 10 people. And so a lot of people would say, hey, I'll help, and never show up. So seek and find the ones that you can depend on, whether it be family, cousins, or brother-in-laws, or whatever. Volunteers are important. And then it begins to grow. They all start to come.
Yeah. It's infectious when the voters see the volunteer base growing, they buy into the campaign, right. And it makes it much, much easier to be successful.
And you got to print them T-shirts.
David will tell you how those signs start going up.
Let me make a comment, which I'll kind of sum up where he is right now. They've been kind of bouncing back and forth. To sum up, when you talk about the candidate, what the young people here must realize, you've got to establish your ties in the local community. I had many, many ties in the local community. I grew up near the area, went to school in the area, so I had a great body of friends who even over the years have known me close hand. They still like me. I don't know how, but they did. And you've got to, if you don't have ties in the community, being born there, you need to conduct your life where you do have friends, where people like you. And you've got to build that circle. And you've got to go into the community. And if you're, no matter what your feelings are, you should get active in some sort of a church or some sort of a community group. You should be the playgrounds, coach a baseball team. Get involved in the community. Let people know you're one of them. And make sure that everybody in these organizations that you deal with knows, you know, you're there for them. If they have their cars broken down, need somebody to pick them up, you pick them up. You help them out. Their family needs some help, you help them. You know, be sincere. Be real. And when the time comes for your campaign, they'll get out there and work and fight for you just like they know that you've backed them up. You've got to build your ties. All these things are important. The media is going to come at you and say, you're an anti-Semite or you're a racist or, you know, whatever. You're a Nazi or whatever. They're going to say whatever they want to say. But when you can point that you've been active in the Red Cross, you know, you've been active in the Special Olympics, or you've been active in the community service in some possible way. I wouldn't be active in the United Way because they support the NAACP. But I would be active in something like the Red Cross or something like that. And that gives you credentials which start to dispel this image they're trying to create of you. You know, you just don't see Hitler in the Red Cross. You know what I mean? You understand what I'm saying? They're trying to make all of us into a Hitler because that's their stereotypes. All right, your message. When you run for an office, politics is the art of the possible. We're not telling you to get up there and deny anything that you believe, but what you do is you focus on issues that people are going to vote for in that election. Now, if you're running for school board, you should talk about what the textbooks are for these kids. You know, what's going on in the schools, the violence, how that sometimes the white children are facing violence and the school board will never stand up for the white children. They always take the side of the minorities because the minorities have the backing. you know, talk about the issues that correspond with our beliefs that are important, you know, in terms of our beliefs and these schools. If you're running for city council, you have the same principle. Where's your taxes going in the city, in the town? How are they being used? Now, as you start going up in races, for instance, like a House of Representatives race, which is a natural race for most states, you're a small enough district that your presence can count. It doesn't take a great deal of money. It does take a certain amount of money. I mean, don't run for these offices unless you're prepared to spend between $10,000 and $30,000 minimum for like a House race. If you use that of your own money, you have to save it for a long time to do it or take loans, you can do it. If you can do it through your local organizational efforts, you can do it. But you've got to have a minimum amount of money. But the beautiful thing is that in a race where you have an election decided by just a few votes, where you're talking about 25,000 registered voters in a district, you're talking about basically, what, 8,000 or 9,000 homes, because you're talking about 2.5 to 3 people per household. 8,000 homes, if you start early enough, you can knock on most of those doors. Now, the most important impression to the voter is not what they see on television or a radio commercial, but if you meet the person, you shake their hand, you talk to them, you show their interest, you look pleasant, you look good, you work with them, you say things they want to hear. And let me tell you, the average voter thinks like we think. The average European American still in this country does. Sometimes they disguise a little bit and they're afraid to come out, but they think like we think. Every poll has shown 80% of the American people are opposed to affirmative action. 80% of the European Americans, anyway. 80% of the European Americans are opposed to immigration. 80%. 80% of the people are for neighborhood schools and not for busing. And that's another code word for simply wanting to be around their own people. 80% don't like their tax money used to promote this massive illegitimacy, basically replacing our people by another population, right? So the people have basically the same principles and issues that we have. And I tell you, I believe 80% truly, if you start talking to them, really don't want our troops to be overseas. You know, they want to protect America. They're concerned about America. So what do we have to do? We have to reach those people. You've got to give a message that they can understand specifically. You don't have to talk. If I'm running for the House of Representatives in Louisiana, we're going to go on a second. When I run for the House of Representatives in Louisiana, I'm not going to be spending all my time talking about our Israeli policy. That's not why they're going to vote for me to the Louisiana House race. In fact, when I ran for governor, which doesn't deal with foreign issues, they'd always ask me about things like, well, you know, you say the Jews control the media. What are you going to say about that? And I said, well, of course the Jews control the media. You know, and then I went on and talked about the real issues because I didn't want to get bogged down in those superfluous issues concerning our own local races. You don't back down off your issues, but you talk about the issues that are critical in those elections. That's how you get elected. And that's true of any organization or any regime in the world. If you want to go back to Germany, you want to go back to Franco, Spain, any of these countries, you look and see how they ran those elections. And I'm just commenting some of the things we went through. The volunteers, again, that's critical. Now, if you're knocking on every door, but you have 3 or 4 people, and behind you another day, other people are knocking on doors, the impact. Suddenly, this voter says, not only has David Duke visited me personally, he's concerned about me, he's got his phone line open for me to call him if I have an issue of importance, but all these other people are knocking on my door, and these people are presentable and decent. You know, and then you start getting commitments.
Another thing we did relative to the canvassing where David was knocking on the doors is that we would identify which areas he would be knocking on doors on a given day, and we would give those the same list of voters to our telephone bank, and they would be calling the people that we expected David to see and make our telephone bank presentation to them prior to David, or at the same time that David was knocking on their door. So they felt a rush of a campaign. So it wasn't just, well, we hear David here, and then a couple weeks later we hear something. No, we were hitting them all at the same time with both barrels. And what David did that was very, very intelligent, and this was his idea. I got to give him this one. No school I had ever gone to mentioned this. David's idea was when he started knocking on doors, he was going to go to the major thoroughfares first. And that way, when he got assigned location and there was 50,000 cars went past that location during a given day, 50,000 people saw that sign. If he had it on a little back cul-de-sac street, like where I live, the 10 people that live in the community would have saw the sign first. But he got the maximum exposure because he worked the thoroughfares first. And then the remainder of the communities just started falling in line. And they started calling, send us a sign. They felt left out.
And that's the key. Let me tell you, your sign presence is a key in these elections. And I hope, you know, it's funny, this is kind of a dull subject for most people. It's not as exciting as talking about international Zionism. But I see people paying close attention here. The politics, local politics, is the soft underbelly of this empire. That is your place where you can penetrate. That's what the British National Party is doing right now. It's a very intelligent approach. And this is what we've got to do across America. Now, in terms of signs, let's talk about that for a second. In politics, it's not just what you say that's important. As important as what you say and whether people agree with you or not is the perception that you can win or you will not win. And you've always worked to make sure that you have the perception or people can get the perception that you have support and you have a possibility of winning. That is the most effective way, one of the most effective ways that the Jewish supremacists hurt our party. And I bet you John Tyndall could say the same thing happens in Britain. What they do is they say, oh, the British National Party has no chance whatsoever. And so the voters say, I've got to choose between another party. In the last election that I did, the last major election, which was a run for Congress, you saw some of the signs from that in the last election, they had six major candidates in that race for an open seat that came forward. Six major candidates. All of them were millionaires except for me. And they all ran significant campaigns. Each one of them spent over $250,000 in that campaign. We were able to raise about $150,000, which was, you know, again, we don't expect to raise as much as our opposition, but we raised a pretty good amount in that campaign. It was too much of a shortened campaign for us, but we worked hard. We had a lot of support out there. The polls kept saying that I had no support. They said that we had 3%, 4%, 5% of the vote. And they lied. Well, they lied, obviously. And they tried to, and this hurt our campaign a lot, saying, well, maybe David Duke doesn't have it anymore. Maybe he can't get the support that he needed. We knew this wasn't true, because we were out there and we saw the support we had. And we had a lot of support and a lot of signs. And the day before the election, the Times-Picayune ran a full page. This is, of course, our New York Jew House newspaper. And they ran a big headline on the front page. It's a three-person race. David Treen, who was the former governor of the state, Monica, this woman ophthalmologist who was running, stuck a lot of money in the campaign, and David Vitter, who was a Harvard graduate and the scion of the intellectual and the rich establishment.
Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah, establishment. They said, the rest of it, there was nobody else in the race. You know, David Duke wasn't even going to be a factor. So election night came around, and it was the day before the campaign. Election night came around, and we're sitting there watching the returns, and for three quarters of the night, guess who led the race? I led the race. And the way it ended up was 23% for David Treen, 22.5% for David Treen, 21% for David Vitter, and 20% for David Duke. We came within one percentage point of being in the lead. And we talked to people all over the district. This would be a runoff for the United States Congress. Now, that would have propelled us to international news again. There would have been 1,000 reporters at the doorstep the next day if that would have happened.
And that campaign was run on a shoestring.
And that campaign was run on a shoestring. But the next day, I ran into people, and by the way, to show you that we do have political strength and power, we carried two different parishes. It's about four parishes. We carried two parishes in that race, two whole parishes. That's the same as counties. We carried them. We were first place. And the next day, I ran into people everywhere. Well, I was going to vote for you, but I didn't. I thought you were out of the race. I thought you didn't have a chance. You know, I didn't want to have this other bad guy get in, and I thought I had to make a decision between those, which was the least of the two evils. And this you hear every day all across America. This is their major tactic. All they got to do is tell people, Kent didn't have a chance. So you got to show a visible force in your campaign. So a local campaign, since your money doesn't go very far in media, which usually covers a wide area, like a television show or radio programming, so you're not cost effective. The best place to put your money is in the literature, direct mailings to those homes, to literature you give out, make sure it's of high quality, and to yard signs, and to other major signs. And of course, anywhere in this country, you're allowed to put up political yard signs or something. Yard lawn. Now, a yard sign changes the whole psychology. And once a person says, put your sign in my yard, wow, first of all, you've got that person cemented in. He's never going to vote for any of the other candidates. Secondly, it starts telling people that it's okay to vote for David Duke, that maybe he's not so bad. Maybe the media has not, you know, convinced them of this fact. And once you have a large number of signs, in fact, what we would do is we go out and I'd knock on doors for 2.5 to 3 months, and I'd get yard sign commitments. But we wouldn't put up any signs. We waited till we had a significant press. You don't wait too long, because once you get signs, everybody wants to put up signs. But we waited till in our district, for instance, we won that race. We waited for a while. And then one morning, we brought about 6 yard crews out from about 8 o'clock at night to about 6 o'clock the next morning. And the district woke up, and suddenly there were over 2,000 David Duke signs on yards of houses. 2,000 houses on yards where there's only 8,000 houses in the district. There were no other candidates. And suddenly, the world changed, okay? The image changed. At that point, David Duke's going to win. People started getting this contagion. My God, we can actually get a guy who stands up for us openly in the House of Representatives. At that point, people went from saying, ex Ku Klux Klansman, this is bad, to thinking, wow, we know his background, he's going to stand up for us. His background is not negative, but it proves he's going to stand up for us. It proves he's not like the other guys, and he stands up and says what he means. Because nobody, no young person that would join that group would do so for personal advantage. He would do so because he had beliefs, because he stood up for those beliefs. So the psychology changed, and that's where we go from there. Now we'll go on.
I don't have signs on the list, but I do have to make a comment about how to construct a sign, how to design a sign.
Yeah.
You really want to choose your colors wisely. First of all, you don't want your sign to be too busy, because people driving by don't have time to read everything on the sign. They just want to see the name and the position he's running for. The name and the position he's running for. And make sure you have a good contrast of colors. And studies show the two best colors to use, are the David Duke blue, outstanding color, with the dark blue sign with the white reverse lettering. Stands out at night when you're driving down the street, the headlights jump off of that thing. And the other one, the good one to use, is a nice dark green and white. Green is a nice cool color. Blue is a nice cool color. Green tells everybody everything that's green is good. You know, we eat green foods. You know, that keeps us alive. Money's green. That's good. Green is a good color, particularly for campaigns. It's a psychological thing, but it's extremely important, and it draws people's eyes to it. If you have some screwy orange and black, some other purplish things, people turn their heads away. They don't like to look at those things, but they will look at the soft colors as they drive.
And blue is equally good, or maybe sometimes better, in the sense that it's studies have shown that it's well over the most popular color of people is the color blue. So that's another positive about blue. And blue has some assimilations and some associations, I guess, with the white race, with our ancestry as well.
Make sure it's a good quality sign, too, and somebody doesn't already have those colors.
And the best thing is, don't worry about trying to put a picture in the sign. Again,
no.
On these yard signs, anything outside, it's the weather's going to take it. You can't see it very well. You make sure you have good pictures, quality pictures of you on the literature. And you should have good 8.5 by 11 size literature, not just a small folding. Well, you got a good enough picture where the guy feels he's really seeing you, that you're close to him, and there's a sense of connection there, a sense of contact.
You don't want your photograph on a yard sign or a billboard or something out there, because people are going to doodle on it. There was a race here in Louisiana, 25 years ago. A local sheriff, Al Cronvich, running against the guy that's in office now, Harry Lee. Al Cronvich was accused of illegal wiretaps. And he had his signs out there with his beautiful bald-headed pitcher that he thought everybody loved. And they put these signs up all over the major thoroughfares, and every arm they could twist, every business had to have one out there, or they suffered the consequences of the sheriff. Well, they come by 2 nights later, and every one of these photographs had listening equipment drawn on the ears. You know? I guarantee you that's not the message he wanted to get out.
And also, you know,
I wonder who did that.
I've got to tell you, too, that Howie was responsible for the design of our signs, completely responsible. And when I heard his ideas on that, I realized they were correct. A simple design also makes the sign look larger than it actually is. When a sign's busier, the sign doesn't look as big. It doesn't look as powerful. And when you get those large yard locations on the main thoroughfares, put your larger signs there. Put your smaller signs in the background.
Right.
Okay.
And if you're a controversial candidate, make sure you put them high.
Now we had
high in the trees and the phone poles, because your opposition, as you go through an area and put them up, the signs will come down.
Any National Alliance member, any Euro member, any other person that's identified as quote an extremist by the media, especially for the cause of European Americans and against Zionism, is going to engender a tremendous opposition from those radical elements in the community. And we this is one thing we had to fight, and it was a tremendous,
horrible
fight. It was a horrible fight for us. We had tremendous vandalism against our signs. People would drive into the yards and drive over the signs. They'd steal the signs. They'd burn. We've had signs burned on people's lawns, but there were no federal indictments for that. We had, it was just amazing, and we had to keep crews going almost around the clock just to replace the signs.
We had one unique sign crew that would work the swamps along the interstates, and they would climb the trees in the swamps and stick these signs way up in the top of the trees. And I was getting telephone calls from other candidates, people within their campaigns who I personally knew, like Aaron Broussard, a good friend of mine, was running in the governor's race against David. He calls up, he said, I just drove in from Baton Rouge, and he said, I was on the interstate going through the swamps, and he says, and I was seeing David Duke signs on top of all of these trees. How did you guys do that?
Trained monkeys.
In fact, in the local areas, when you have a street corner, and we're trying to teach you little tricks, and I know that some of you are not going to remember all these things, but you're getting some ideas here. And later on, you can contact us. Contact Howie. Howie and Kenny are willing and able to consult with you on these issues and to help you in terms of your campaigning. And I am too. But we used to do a lot of 4x8s. And boy, when you have a 4x8 yeah. Duke sign, it looks huge. That big field of blue and then the white letters. And we would put these up about 12 feet in the air. And it's a little harder to correct them on 2x4s. But people couldn't get the spray going. I mean, I tell you, there must be a heck of a lot of Nazis in my district, because I saw swastikas all over my signs. But so you put these signs high, and it's much more difficult for them to steal it, take it, you know. And we used to also lay traps on the signs for cars if they tried to
put the
lock them down.
Little roofing nails around the signs, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a really hilarious situation.
We drive a steel pipe into the ground that's pointed out that you can't see it when you're driving up, and it's right there in the weeds, but it's aimed right
at
that.
It's really funny when you find it disabled. Cops come up and the disabled car.
They'd run that radiator right into that pipe.
Signs on the ground.
It was a war.
We'd put signs over the canals, but we'd have to climb over these service pipes that cross the canal, whether it be water or electric service pipes, we'd climb over those and have these guys put these signs up in the canal bottoms, sticking up right out the canal. So the opposition would go out on those pipes and pull them up and throw them away. So the next thing we did, we put our signs back up, and then we took Vaseline and put it all over the pipes. And these guys would come walking out there, boom, next thing you know, they're in that canal. And if you ever seen anybody fall in one of these muddy things, man, I mean, they come out of there with slop on them that nobody wants on them, man.
It was really almost a game. you would put the signs out, and the next morning it'd all be gone. It was like unbelievable. Who are these people doing this? You know?
But I tell you, signs are critical because the psychology totally changes. When people think it's okay, then they think they see their neighbors putting up a big sign, and suddenly their inside feelings, their own heart, can start to be expressed and say, I can do that too. We can have this change.
You also, too, and we have to move on, but if you have to have a crew that when the signs are gone, the crew has to get right back out there and put them back up. Two more things I'd like to mention, too, is make sure that you're playing devil's advocate. Make sure that if you're all going to put signs up on telephone poles and places that you're not violating any local ordinances where you live, because they can fine you per sign. And get expensive.
Yeah. Well, here they do. I don't know what the laws are where you're from.
Make sure you know what the local laws are.
Make sure you place all your signs legally. And it's very, very important. And particularly with some of these people that want to complain about the environment, you put them where they don't want them, then you have this environmental charge against you. And so that you're writing off a segment of your voting population that you might otherwise get.
And don't put them where they block an intersection, where it may cause an accident. And for lumber, for the sticks that you use to erect your signs, if you go to lumber companies, they sometimes have a lot of scrap stuff that they're going to haul away, and you're asking, can I have it? You know, like we did, we actually rode around in neighborhoods where they were throwing lumber out, took it on a trailer, and went home and cut it up to make sticks for signs.
Well, once you get your presence up and people see your signs and people think you're going to have a good chance of winning, we realize we've got a break for lunch in a minute. Thank you very much.
Well, let's finish up. Just
real quick.
Wait a second. Once that happens, then suddenly people also want to be on the side of a winner, not just because they agree with you, and most of them do anyway, but because they want the influence when you're in office. And at that point, you see the lumber yards up say, well, yeah, I'll donate this lumber to you, or I'll donate this food for your Duke Fest or for your big party. Because, again, that's the whole – you've produced the psychology that people think you're going to win or got a great shot to win, and suddenly the world opens up to you.
You've got
to
get off the stage now.
We got one last
– we got to finish. We mentioned coffee parties and rallies. Coffee parties and rallies are a great way to meet the voters. It's a great way to raise funds. You don't raise a lot of money because when you're having rallies, because you're paying a lot of money out to have the rally, but it's a good advertising situation, and rallies have been very, very successful for David. Coffee parties are outstanding. You get your friends and relatives to start hosting coffee parties where you invite the candidate over, they invite their friends and relatives, and the candidate meets them, and you give me some money. We got to run. You know?
Ask and you shall receive.
You got to ask for the money, or you got to have somebody there that's going to ask for the money. You can't ever pass up an opportunity to ask for a contribution, because that's the lifeblood of your campaign, is the financing. Also, in your advertising, spend your money wisely. Make sure you're getting the biggest bang for your buck, loudest holler for the dollar, because there's not a lot of money out there. I don't care, unless you're Perot, you're not going to have enough money to take advantage of every advertising avenue. So you got to be very, very selective in how you do it, and you sit down and plan that wisely. We generated some real good deals just by haggling with some of the radio stations. They will come down on the price if you haggle with them enough, because that's what they live by.
I've studied the enemy so long, I've learned how to haggle.
Oh yeah, he can haggle.
Barber, huh?
He can haggle. It's a Scotsman.
Won't haggle.
We talked about door knocking. We talked about sign locations. We talked about phone banks. You've got to have a phone bank that keeps you in touch with the voters on a daily basis. The more phones you have, the less time it's going to take you to canvass your area. And you got to use those phone banks on election day. Those are the people, when you're going through, you got to order voter lists so that you know who the registered voters are. And you call all of those registered voters. When you get somebody that says, I'm going to vote for your man, you highlight that name on that list. You compile a list of positive votes. And on election day, you call every one of them. Make sure they go to the polls. If you can get your vote out, and the other guy's lazy and he doesn't get him out, he may have more voters than you based on the what the enemy can do to you, but you'll still win, or you'll at least force them to listen to your message. And then literature is extremely important.
We touched it already.
No, we didn't touch on literature. We didn't touch on the design of literature. And with this, I'm going to wrap up on literature after this, because this is very important. You need literature. You need at least, during the course of a standard campaign, you're going to have at least 3 pieces of literature go out of your campaign to the voting public. There was a study done on effectiveness of marketing materials. This was done for marketing in general, not politics specific. And the study showed that the most effective mailouts or handouts consisted of 4 pages. If it was less than 4 pages, people didn't feel it was worthy to read. And they would throw it away, they'd discard it. Although it's very simple and you can look at a picture and a little catchphrase or something, it didn't really register. 4 pages registered. 5 pages, too bulky, throw it away. 4 pages was the magic number. So every piece of literature we designed with David, we put 4 pages. We had on the front page, we had his picture. We had a letter from David as to what his candidacy is. We opened it up and we had another page there where he talked about a specific issue in depth or a couple of issues. But in the 3 to 4 mailouts or handouts that we were going to do over the course of the campaign, we made sure that we had on that first inside page, we touched on every issue that was pertinent to his campaign, every single one. Not all in the same handout, but before the campaign was over, they got the total message. The third page, we had bullets of what his programs were, what his platform was for that particular campaign. So if they just wanted to see what he was standing for in that race, there's the issues.
The last page,
solicitations. Got to solicit the money. We had solicitations for volunteers, phone bankers,
yard
coffee
signs,
parties, yard signs, and money. We had, look, if you want to send us this, or this. We had a little square they could cut out, check off their names, and mail it into us. And we received some contributions that way. And we generated a hell of a lot of volunteers.
And you profile every volunteer to make sure what they contribute to the campaign, electrician, plumber, singer, artist, whatever.
Right.
That's right. Where you pull from those people when you're trying to do fundraising. Oh, if you can raise the money, it's great.
It depends on the race. Some races, television doesn't really lend itself. It's not, the cost of it, it's not beneficial to the race. The race is too small.
Right.
Now, if you're getting into the statewide race or a congressional race or something like that, where it's a higher profile race, they're all good money buys there. David found
you got to have television the larger the race. But for a house race, you can win a house race without one minute of television. We're gonna cut it out.
Can I mention one thing?
Yes.
Can I mention one thing?
There is a tar and feather party forming in the hallway with my name on it. And I just wanted to, we do have to break for lunch, and there are some people who will have to check out, and then you can come back to the great Willis Cardo and the great Don Black speeches are going to follow, and the forum. And I just wanted to, if I could dare, in front of my boss, to close this out, I wanted to ask Kenny and Howie about 2 amazing things that I've heard from them. I wasn't here, so I didn't witness this amazing thing. I was told the 2 numbers. One was the number of volunteers that they managed to get in their David Duke campaigns, and the other amazing statistic was number of volunteers, and the other was the size of the rallies that they generated. If you guys could give us just those 2 numbers, and then promise to let us all go eat lunch,
okay.
All right? I'll yield the microphone. Otherwise, I'm going to be tarred and feathered.
I'm tarred and feathered.
On a statewide level, we generated over 40,000 volunteers. And what was the other question?
Well, if y'all happen to notice this, the picture was up here. We had a Duke Fest 1990 where we actually fed 4,500 people, I think it was.
14,000.
Was it 14,000?
14,000.
On a zero budget, all donations. Not a dollar came from the campaign. It was all
the
donated.
Louisiana Shrimpers were so good to us that year. It was unbelievable. They supplied us with shrimp and fish and stuff. We had 5 bands played for us, donated their time to play.
We had gifts to give away. What happened?
Yeah.
All right, let's go.
All right, thank you. If we can help you in any way, you can contact us through David's office.